Hello and welcome to the first day without internet. Maybe you've noticed that we are not on the net here, which is, poses a little problem because we need all the stuff that we put online. So we were making sure that everybody sends us the slides, and we have the slides, and they're all online, but we are offline here. So, and I failed in doing a local backup. I must apologize. So the whole thing will start unplanned, chaotic as ever, which we try to avoid. But this is how we do it today. So first, welcome to first day, first round of lightning talks. And before we can start, we can actually, we have to see about the list. Who will be here? And then we decide about an order, which I've done right there. So you can see it here. Maybe I should up the font a little. Oops. Okay. So, basically we went with the basic rule, first come, first serve. However, there's some more equal than others, and those will be the announcements for the workshops. So we want to do the announcements for the workshops first, or those who can only speak today. And the first three on the list, I'll call them now, whether they're here, just to see whether we can, this works out. Should I use the other microphone? Maybe? So, where's Oliver, by the way? Ah, that was okay. I was still looking for a white shirt, but you in blue. Right, so here we go. Ulrich von Zado, you're right there. Okay, Craig is right there. Mitch, I see you there, hey. Okay, then the guys, Kosten Luptak and Schette. Anyone? No. So I take a note, they are not here yet, maybe. Then Hammett. Hammett is here? No. Oops. Anders Bess, you were here, right there. Then Klink. Got it. Parea or Bereja? Parea? No. David Gulasch? No, you're right there, right? Sleep Hacking by Rutten? The girl, it must be a girl. There are girls here. So, all right. Maybe hiding. Then Kai Dietrich, right? Mont for Meet for Real? You're right there. Oh, yes. Please come in front, sit in the first row. You want to do it tomorrow? Ah, okay. Put you down for day two. Okay, but not today. Then, why is hacking so difficult? Yes, Ott. Alexander Ott. Is he here? No. Then, still not know how to pronounce it properly. I forgot to ask. Coinchon, I would guess. That's you? How about my pronunciation? Coinchon? Mr. C. Refer to Mr. C. Right, so let's start this one now. Next one, on Bookscanning, Bressler. Bressler, no, not here yet, not here. Astro, that's you, great. Maushammer, great. Rapp, Mr. Rapp, no. Balka, yeah, that's you, okay. Oh, and here I'm missing one, so very unfortunately, there were still like 40 emails to answer, so I missed one there. If it was you, I'm very sorry. I hope you'll be on day two. I hope you know who you are. Anyway, so, oh, yes, Andreas Krenmeier, not here, but I have his phone number, haha. So, Münich, no Münich, Brachmann. Brachmann, no. Emrys, that's you? Oh, yeah, okay, of course, I've seen you. Yeah, Jakibi, yeah. That's you, please come up front. Please sit. There's one still left there, please sit there. Great. Then fermentology, Gross. I hope it's not spelled gross. So, okay. Then Stefan, the rainbow table guy, there you are. You would prefer day two? All right, let's do it this way. Pablo Hörtner. No, Vienna, still on his plane. All right. Then, whoops. Brüning. Oh, yes, he called me. He didn't get a ticket. So, I hope you all have one or you hacked your way in. Congratulations. We have to see about him. I have to give him a call. Does he get a ticket? Then, Encore.org, Brodu? Then, unfortunately, we have to put you on day two. How was that? That's still okay? Yeah. Okay, great. But basically there. So, cost, yeah? Is cost here? There you are? Tomorrow too? Okay. Everybody wants internet, I see. Then Anselm. Anselm? So also day two. Yeah, we are on day two now. Here we go. Day two, everybody. So if you see yourself here on the server, or just call you whether you happen to be here.
Du hast ihn als nicht anwesend markiert, den zwei Emrys.
Do
you want to speak to that? Okay. Also, mach ihn erst anwesend, erst hier vorne.
Yeah, we want. Ach so.
Day one.
All right. Okay, Anselm will be on day two, Dietrich too. Adler, is he here? You're way in the back. You want to speak tomorrow, right? That was a definite less on two, right? That's day two for you. Speak up. Don't be afraid. Just speak in the camera too, if you like. What about day two? Fine? Or will you do it today? That's good. Two. All right. It's done. Then Bolt with the ACP? Tomorrow too? Well, they're all in the coming days, but if they want to speak today, they might. None? Right. So let me go through the list once more. Let's do a second one. And then... that's the wrong one. All right, so this leaves then. So this will be for day one, which is 17 talks. I think we can go through that. And if everything works all right, then we still even have time. So stick around. When you do have time, it's pretty much okay while we're fiddling around with the hardware that you step up, take the microphone and say, oh, I'm still looking for a parking lot or for an accommodation. So that's your time when you can grab the mic and be here for a minute. Okay? So that should be possible. So the current plan looks like this. We start off with some announcements. So first speaker will be Ulrich von Sado, right? And you got your own one and you got an adapter. Good. This looks good. You got the timing?
Yes.
Watch. Okay, we got this. Maybe just for the camera. We want this on this to see. Geh nicht weiter zurück. Sprich mit mir. Ja, genau. Das sollte Julius sein, aber ich weiß nicht, wo er ist. Genau. Ja. Okay, eine Sekunde, dann. Hallo? Und warte mal, du hast eingetaktet. Beim Maus. Ja. So, you are right there. Okay. Okay. Okay, so this will be day one. Here we go. So just checking, everybody on the list is here, hopefully. We do it like this. We do the first three, and then we take a very short pause. As you can see, most of the talks here today will be in English, And if this information is not correct, you must speak up now. Right? All the speakers? Everybody's okay? Okay, I hope you're prepared for English. So, first three. Ulrich, Craig, Mitch. Right. So here we go. We started with Ole Fanzano on the multi-touch Hackfest.
Hi, I'm Uli, and
we start when you're really ready.
Okay, am I ready? Am I ready?
Let's wait for the picture to happen.
No, I'm not ready. There's supposed to be a picture happening. It's not happening. So this does not count against my time. It should.
No.
Now it is counted. Now it should count against my time. Okay.
Okay,
I'm going to talk about the Multitouch Hackfest that is happening at the Seabase right now and is going to be happening for the next 3 days there. But first, I'm going to talk about the history of Multitouch and the Seabase. We started 3 years ago at the 23C3 with a homemade Multitouch table, which worked to an extent. Had a lot of duct tape in it and got the crowds to cheer and whatever. Yeah, and since then we've been continuing to work on it, but we've got some competition. They were later and they were smaller. Like this Microsoft Surface thing is 30 inch and we've got a full square meter. And this other thing is, I think, about 100 times smaller. But it looks cool, and everybody wants it. So, but we are the good guys, and we're open source, and we love the community, and that's why we are doing this Multitouch Hackfest. We've got two Multitouch devices there, which you can use to program stuff. There's going to be instructions on how to build your own. We've got some material there, not enough for you to buy some from us, but you can experiment. We'll have a few tutorials running. The tutorials start today at 4 o'clock, so you want to be there. We'll have a contest, and on the last day, we'll announce the guy who wrote the coolest application in 4 days of hacking on a multi-touch table. And yeah, 1600 today at the Seabase. A few other things happening in the Seabase. Oh, wait, okay. We start at 11 each day. This is the way to the Seabase. Here be dragons is where the Congress is. That's the Seabase. And we have other things happening at the Seabase. Tomorrow, a party. Then next day, some talks that were rejected by the CCC. We have another party on the 30th. We have another party on the 31st. No party on the 1st of January, and that was it. Schedule is, search for Multitouch Hackfest and on the Congress Wiki. Okay, see you there. You. Time for questions is at 4 o'clock.
You may have seen this guy before. He has been here several times, and he's sticking around at the hardware area. Mitch Altman, the guy known as TV Begone Man. So if you get annoyed in public places about TV screens screaming at you, even without audio, and you need to decide, well, I don't want to see it. Many people don't want to see it. Why is this still thing on? Then you use a TV Begone. Right. And you can hack it here yourself. All right.
Wir haben dieses Jahr Zensuselas Blackbox mitgebracht zum Kongress. Also, ich sage erstmal kurz noch was zu mir. Ich bin Craig vom Chaosdorf. Wir haben dieses Jahr ein Projekt vom Karsdorf mitgebracht, und zwar dient das der Auseinandersetzung mit Zensurmaßnahmen, eben die Sinnhaftigkeit, bringen die überhaupt irgendwas, und eben auch eine Sensibilisierung in dem Bereich zu schaffen. Ja, außerdem wollen wir euch natürlich animieren, die gesamte Schicht zu umgehen. Wie ihr sicher alle wisst, ist das Frau Leyens Meinung, endlich sauberes Internet durch Zensur. Gut, das war öfter in der Presse, wir haben es dann auch diskutiert, nur die Sache war halt die, bringt es halt wirklich was? Also, really? Deswegen haben wir im Club dann diskutiert, wir haben verschiedene Arten von Sperren angeguckt, also kennt ihr sicher die NS-Sperren, Content-Filter, also Inhaltsfilter, haben dann auch getestet, wie können wir das Ganze umgehen, zum Beispiel durch Tunneling, und natürlich, was für Seiteneffekte der Zensur gibt es überhaupt? Wir sind zu dem Ergebnis gekommen, klar, löschen statt sperren. Die gesamte Geschichte funktioniert nicht so weit, dass es noch usable bleibt. Also man muss nachher zu viel sperren, wenn man wirklich jede Art von Tunnel sperren möchte. Gut, so zu der Blackbox. Wir haben uns eine kleine Story ausgedacht. Also Zensula hat leider ihren Laptop verloren, er wurde uns eben zugetragen. Wir haben dann festgestellt, dass er IPs über die ACP verteilt und leider auch das Internet zensiert. Also das Gerät steht unten an unserem Stand, neben dem Fahrstuhl ist der, und ja, wir würden uns halt freuen, wenn er da mal hinkommt und das Ganze ausprobiert, versucht die verschiedenen Level zu umgehen. Also noch kurz, das lasse ich mal weg, die verschiedenen Level. Level 1 ist laienhaft umgesetzt worden, ihr könnt euch sicherlich vorstellen, was das bedeutet. Level 2 ist schon ein kleines bisschen schwieriger. Und Level 3 ist eben Sensor Dinejad, State-of-the-Art Censorship. Wir versuchen halt Level 3 möglichst unknackbar zu halten, was dann auf Kosten der Usability geht. Das werdet ihr sehen, wenn ihr es selber ausprobiert. Ja, wer Level 3 knackt oder die ersten 5 Personen kriegen eine Mate oder eben bei besonderer Performance, das ist unser Spezialpreis. Wir haben das Ganze auf der Open Rhein-Ruhr schon mal getestet. Wir hatten nur 15 Zensuropfer. Wie ihr seht, die Level wurden alle schon mal geknackt. Danach haben wir aber nochmal Level 3 überarbeitet. Also jetzt ist es wieder schwieriger. Die Open Rhein-Ruhr ist aber weniger ein Bring-Your-Own-Event. Also Leute sind mit Laptop nicht dabei. Deswegen hoffen wir natürlich auf euch. Ja, wir wollen eben, dass ihr vorbeikommt, das Ganze ausprobiert und eben Spaß mit der Zensurbox habt beim Umgehen derselbigen. Ja, wie gesagt, unten neben dem Fahrstuhl, versucht euer Bestes. Ja.
My name is Mitch Altman, there's some contact info, and I'm, like Sven said, most probably well known for TV Be Gone, turning TVs off in public places. If we don't do it, who will? But today I'm going to talk really just more like to a pep talk for making cool things with microcontrollers. But I want to start off, as I often do in my talks, about work. People tend not to like their work. In my country, I looked it up on the internet, which of course is the font of all truth, 80% of Americans do not like their job, which is a real bummer when you consider we spend a third of our lives at work. So, but my name is Mitch Altman, I turn TVs off for a living, and I love my job. I really want to encourage all of you to consider finding work that you really like, and even better, that you love, because if we can make a living doing what we love, our lives become better, and hopefully what we make we love, and the world becomes better around us. I make my living selling TV Be Gone. I go around doing these workshops. I pretty much just break even from them. I just do them because I love them. And as long as I make enough money doing this other thing I love, TV Be Gone, I am totally happy. So you can see a lot of other people become happy when they play with hardware. So I like infecting people with hardware. And there's a picture of last year. This hardware thing keeps growing at these congresses, and I keep pushing. So I'm going to be giving a workshop downstairs in AO4 in the Hackspace all day, all night. Occasionally I'll sleep and eat, but come on down. It's a lot of fun, and I want to show you some things that I make and that I have kits for. So I started off with this whole trip by making TV Be Gone and then hacking it. So here's some variations on TV Be Gone. The original keychain, I started off as a patented closed source thing, going the normal route. And quickly from getting acquainted with the whole hacker scene, seeing the error of my way and making it an open source project. And together with Lady Ada made the TV Be Gone kit, which turns off TVs from, from 50 meters away. And sometimes, though, 50 meters isn't enough, and TVs need to be turned off from further, and then you need the professional model. For professionals only, but you can do it at home, and I'm really excited about the brand new TV Be Gone Pro, which turns off TVs from 150 meters. This might look familiar. Anyways. I made this project for Make Magazine, which turned out to be pretty popular, a brain machine. And the way I made it very easy for anyone to make, and I wanted people who'd never made anything ever before to try to make something. So brain machine, and I hacked it from a ready-made kit that's very easy to make called Mini POV, and we have those. And these are just some of the things that I'll have kits for down in the Hack Center. And let's see, also this game kit that me and my friend Rolf made. I can teach anyone to solder, and Jimmy and other people are down there. We can all teach anyone to solder. It's really fun, it's a great tool, and you can hack these things and make your own cool projects from them. So that's pretty much my
time is up, but do you want to hear the rest of what he has to say?
Okay, I just really have about maybe 60 seconds more. Let's see, here's one more project. This one, you wave your hand over it and waves of colors follow you around. I just think that's really cool. I don't know, people tend to like blinky lights. So. A microcontroller is really just a whole computer on a chip, and there's a little block diagram, but it has some extra stuff where you can play with actual inputs and outputs and affect the world we live in. And it's just, I think electronics and computers are just so cool because we can have this conceptual stuff just in our head, an idea, we can play around with a few models and actually change the reality around us. And that's actually magic. But to come up with a project with a microcontroller or anything for that matter, inventing, you have an idea, you play around with some hardware, with microcontrollers you have firmware, which is the controlling software, and you end up with something hopefully really cool. But the thing is, the easy way to do something is not to just come up with an idea and then from scratch make something cool, but you can hack things that already exist. Like I hacked the mini POV kit into a brain machine, starting with something really cool and make something else really cool. So I can also hack the mini POV kit into all sorts of things. And here's my first version of the TV Be Gone kit, which I hacked from the mini POV kit. You can see the hardware is basically the same, but I got rid of some red lights and put in an infrared light, which remote controls work with, and programmed it with the programming port to have remote control intervals instead of display intervals. And for those who don't know, a mini POV is this thing you wave back and forth and it makes pictures or words in the space that you wave it through. And it's a really cool, easy project that can be hacked into lots of things. Here I am turning off TVs at a Best Buy. I put a TV Be Gone kit in a hat. So Best Buy is kind of like Mediamarkt, which is conveniently across the street for target practice for anyone who's interested. And I hacked the kit into the Pro, and then the Pro was kind of big and bulky, so I hacked it into something more convenient. You can hack hacks, and you can hack hacked hacks, and you just go on and on. I also hacked the Mini POV into this RGB light that makes all sorts of trippy, nice colors by replacing the red with the red, green, and blue, and reprogramming it with something called pulse width modulation. Just pulses the lights to make it look like the light's fading in and out. I hacked that into that thing that you wave by adding a remote control sensor. Remote control sensors are very important because without them, TVs can't turn off. So those things are very sophisticated, but they make about 150 million of them every 10 seconds. So they're actually quite cheap. Infrared comes out of that emitter, bounces off your hand, gets on there and resets the thing, and that's what gives it the effect of this swarm colored waves thing. So here's the thing, I don't have a kid anymore, but it's a little bug bot. You give him some light, he sings and dances, spins his tail, and he vibrates, and he crawls off the table and breaks himself, which is why I don't have him around anymore. A brand new kit that I have, I hacked this little teeny mini cube, 3x3x3 cube, it's just a really cool 3D display. Of course, inspired by Der Blinken Lights one, but this one you can do in a couple hours rather than a month. And then, of course, the brain machine. This is two lights in front of your eyes instead of on the mini POV, and programmed for brainwaves instead of display, and then you have something totally different and cool as well. So they are really fun at parties. Here's a fun bunch of people at, I think this is mostly from Chaos Camp a couple years ago. Anyways, come on down, hack, we can teach anyone to do stuff, do cool things, and do cool things in your life.
So another setup change, I'm sorry for that. Next one is the talk about the PlomLomBot. The PlomLomBot remixes the tweets of Christian Heller, aka PlomLompom, and the generated phrases frequently reveal amusing connections between otherwise unrelated topics. PlomLomBot is written in Python and is using Markov chains.
Okay, ja. Der PlomLomBot ist ein Bot und ihr findet ihn auf Twitter unter dieser URL. Viel Spaß beim Abscannen dieses Dings da. Und der PlomLomBot remixt die Tweets von Plom, das ist Plom. Vielleicht kennt ihr ihn aus dem Chaos Radio oder vielleicht habt ihr ihn schon mal irgendeinen Vortrag halten sehen. Auf jeden Fall, Plom ist Futurist und glaubt, dass in der Zukunft alles besser ist und wir auf die Singularität zusteuern. Und das hat mich dazu inspiriert, den PlomLomBot zu machen, denn auf der SIGINT früher in diesem Jahr in Köln hat Plom einen Vortrag gehalten, hat da die Frage gestellt, du möchtest dich in unsterbliche Computersoftware verwandeln, vielleicht machst du es schon. Und seine Erklärung war halt, je mehr persönliche Daten man ins Netz stellt, desto wahrscheinlicher ist es, dass man später irgendwann resimuliert werden kann. Also weil dann ist ja halt klar, wie man sich zum Beispiel in bestimmten Situationen verhalten würde oder was man sagen würde. Und da hatte ich eine Idee, nämlich Plom ist auch auf Twitter, das sieht ungefähr so aus. Und da dachte ich mir, mache ich halt ein Programm, den PlomLomBot, das ist so das Logo davon. Der benutzt einen Algorithmus namens Dissociated Press, um halt seine Tweets zu remixen und Tweets zu machen, die Plom vielleicht also sagen könnte. Und das funktioniert folgendermaßen, wir haben jetzt ein paar Sätze, wir zerhacken die und basteln uns daraus neue Sätze. Ganz genau heißt zwei Prozesse, das Dissoziieren, das Assoziieren. Beim Dissoziieren nehmen wir einen Satz, also nehmen wir an A, B, C, D, E, F und speichern zu jedem Token im Satz, was kommt davor und was kommt danach. Und wenn wir das noch mit weiteren Sätzen machen, also hier zum Beispiel den Satz C, A, F, F, E, E, dann haben wir halt wieder eine weitere Liste, auf der drauf steht, was kommt davor und was kommt danach. Und wenn wir diese Listen zusammenführen, nachdem wir das mit ganz vielen Sätzen gemacht haben, haben wir halt verschiedene Möglichkeiten. Also nach einem A könnte zum Beispiel ein B oder ein F kommen. Nach einem C könnte ein D oder ein A kommen. Und dann können wir das Assoziieren machen, nämlich uns neue Sätze zusammensetzen. Also in diesem Fall A, B, B, C, D, A, F, E. Also was in dem vorherigen Satz irgendwie latent drin war, aber eigentlich dann doch nicht. Und dann haben wir einen neuen Satz. Und das sieht ungefähr so aus. Also twitter.com/plomlombot. Ja, und jetzt kurz drei Highlights, was er halt so getwittert hat, was ordentlich gefafft wurde auf Twitter. Mir wird hier gerade zu wenig Chuck Norris. Das kann man nicht lesen, aber da steht, Poststrukturalismus ist auch nur noch vom Spiegel Online Artikelrülpsen generiert. Und meiner Meinung nach das Beste, Maschinen haben sehr viel schneller Selbstverbesserungsalgorithmen entwickelt als die SPD. Ja, und ich muss sagen, ich war auch sehr überrascht, dass halt solche Sachen dabei rauskommen, aber es kommt nebenbei auch noch viel Müll raus, nur die Fachautomatik ja, schickt halt das Tolle nach oben. Ja, und viel Spaß da. Der Source Code ist natürlich auf GitHub, wobei wir da gestern nochmal dran saßen und auch vermutlich im Verlauf des Kongresses da noch was basteln werden. Denn vollautomatisiert ist er noch nicht. Ja, viel Spaß beim Abscannen der Barcodes in den nächsten 30 Sekunden.
Ich wollte heute ein bisschen über DNSSEC sprechen. Ich weiß nicht, wer sich mit DNSSEC schon mal beschäftigt hat. In meinem Leben gondel ich da so seit 8 Jahren hinterher. Das Thema ist ungefähr 20 Jahre alt. DNS hat eine fürchterliche Eigenschaft. Es ist nämlich, deren Sicherheit basiert halt einfach auf der Kenntnis von zwei kleinen Zifferchen. Weil das Ganze in der Regel connectionlos basiert, braucht man also nur ein klein bisschen zu wissen, von welchem Port die Query kam und die Transaction-ID. Und ansonsten, wenn ich die zwei Sachen weiß, kann ich also jede Wahrheit unterschieben, zu welchem Rechner er denn bitte seine Verbindung aufbauen möchte. Und das Ganze verbreitet ganz schön Chaos. Hat also vor 2 Jahren, wo ein kleiner Dan Kaminski mal kurz gezeigt hat, wie einfach das Ganze ist, für ein riesen Chaos gesorgt. Es wurden also, ich weiß nicht, wie viele Nameserver auf der Welt abgedatet. Microsoft hat Salty geschlagen, obwohl sie vorher steifenfest behauptet haben, das geht doch gar nicht. Hat dazu geführt, dass man an der Software weitergearbeitet hat, wobei weniger das Problem die Software war, sondern die Umgebung. Hat mich auch ein bisschen überrascht, ich hatte das Thema schon eigentlich begraben gehabt, aber es gab so Anzeichen, dass jetzt DNSSEC tatsächlich kommt, was man von IPv6 noch nicht so sagen kann. 2008 ging es also los, da kam nur eine kurze Order aus dem Präsidentenamt und sagte, erzählt uns doch mal bei .gov, wann führt ihr denn den ganzen Kram ein und wenn ihr noch keinen Zeitplan habt, sagt uns mal, warum nicht. Also da fing die Panik an, um sich zu greifen. Genau das Gleiche, was die Plattformen eingibt, die also bei der US-Regierung eingesetzt worden konnten, das sorgte dann bei Microsoft für Panik. Weil DNSSEC hatte da eigentlich noch keinen festen Platz. Inzwischen sieht es ein bisschen anders aus. Windows 7 und auch der blöde Server kann jetzt also schon ein bisschen DNSSEC, also das Feigenblättchen, um das Zeugs weiter benutzen zu dürfen. Ähnlich sieht es in Deutschland aus. Also auch da führte das Ganze so ein kleines Schattendasein. Inzwischen geht es da ein bisschen vorwärts. Also es gibt ein offizielles Testbett. Und andere TLDs sind da also schon eine ganze Menge weiter. Was mich total überrascht hat, es gab ein Riesengezerre, wer signiert denn jetzt eigentlich das Ding, weil da irgendwelche Leute einen Machtschlüssel hintersahen, wobei bisher hat sich auch niemand darauf aufgeregt, wer da die Root veröffentlicht. Und für mich total überraschend kam plötzlich das Announcement, wir machen es jetzt. Also die alten Verdächtigen, die sowieso schon immer A-Root betrieben haben, dürfen dem Ganzen jetzt auch einen Schlüssel aufdrücken und man hat dafür einen Zeitplan veröffentlicht. Also im nächsten Jahr kommt DNSSEC, wenn nichts schief geht. Offizieller Zeitplan ist draußen, so sieht also der Zeitplan aus. Das heißt, in wenigen Tagen wird das Ganze online gestellt werden und sukzessive auf allen Root-Servern. Probleme sind aus meiner Sicht eigentlich kaum zu erwarten. Das große Problem im operativen Bereich ist eigentlich, es haben viel zu wenig Leute Erfahrung damit. Deswegen mein Aufruf an euch, beschäftigt euch mit diesem Thema, weil es gibt noch einige Unbekannte. Einige der Autoren, die an der Software noch fleißig mit rumschreiben, hat zum Beispiel überraschend festgestellt, dass sein DNS-Router leider keine DNSSEC-Pakete passieren lässt. Und ein weiteres Problem ist also, wie kommt der öffentliche Schlüssel in die Registry rein? Wie gesagt, es gibt also noch viel zu tun, viel zu experimentieren. Wer sich schon ein bisschen mit öffentlichen Schlüsseln PGP, X509 und so weiter auskennt, der wird keine Überraschungen finden. Ich habe hier hinten noch gesagt, ja, was kann ich denn tun? Schaut euch einfach mal die Slides an. Hier sind auch noch jede Menge Links, auf die ich jetzt nicht eingehe, die findet ihr dann in den Slides. Da sind auf jeden Fall jede Menge Ansatzpunkte, warum ihr euch mit dem Thema beschäftigen sollt und ja, wo kriegt ihr jetzt erste Informationen. Vielen Dank.
So, the next lightning talk is about VoiceBuff. So, to give you some keywords, PentaBuff, Asterix, audio navigation for PentaBuff, that's all we got. So, the rest we will hear now. Thank you.
Hi everybody, I'm Alech. If you don't want to listen to my talk, you can just remember those phone numbers and try them out yourself. And the rest will be in this talk. So, 7666 on your deck, that's soon, and 8255, that's talk. So let's find out what those are really about. Those end up in VoiceBarf. VoiceBarf is a short application that HC and I hacked together during the last few months. That's a PentaBarf and Asterisk combination. I guess some people might have heard about PentaBarf already. PentaBarf is a conference planning system, actually the one that is used to plan, for example, this conference or several other CCC conferences around Germany and several other conferences as well. Asterisk, probably even more people have heard about that. That's a voice over IP server, which you can do all kinds of fun voice over IP stuff with. And yeah, VoiceBuff is the combination of those two. Basically, it's a voice interface for conferences. So you can do all kinds of stuff. You can listen to which talks will run and which talks are currently running, for example. It also supports some quite nice features like reminders, so you can tell the system, oh, that sounds like an interesting talk, please give me a call back 5 minutes before it starts, so I don't forget that it starts. And you can also rate talks using your phone. So you could already do that using the web interface on PentaBuff, but now you can also do it via the phone, which is a nice thing, I guess. So redundancy is good because redundancy is good. So 7666 is the phone number of VoiceBarf soon. So you might have guessed that's the number where you will see which talks will start soon. So the next talks that will start somewhere and that you'll hear that, try it out. And 8255 is the list of talks that are currently running where you can also rate them. So how did we do that? VoiceBarf is implemented in Ruby. I've played with Ruby for the last, I don't know, 2-3 months maybe, coming from Perl, and I really enjoy Ruby. If you haven't tried it out, give it a shot. It's a nice language. And while looking around the Ruby community, I'd say I stumbled over the Adhesion framework, which is the framework we use there. It's a framework for doing cool stuff with Ruby and Asterisk. And there's a little code snippet on the screen there. You can see, for example, you have just a simple input method, which you can say, oh, I'd like the user to input a DTMF tone, and then you get a number back from that, and you can do all kinds of stuff with that number. So you can build your own menu system, for example, and stuff like that. Or you can create a database entry to call somebody back. Yeah, and people learn by repetition, so the number again is 7666, which is soon, and 8255, which is talk as a vanity number. So there will be tests later, remember those numbers. That's pretty much it. Yeah, that's the last slide here. The source code is online. That's the URL, git.alech.de. If you want to run it, there's not a lot of documentation right now because we've been hacking it yesterday night for 4 hours or so until early in the morning, so we didn't really write the documentation how to set it up. It's pretty easy, just talk to me if you want to run it at a different conference. This is my email address, voicepath@alich.de. I'm 2412 on the DECT system, just think Christmas if you want to remember it. I'm at Alech on Twitter, and I'd like to give a quick thanks to HC, who did some of the coding for the reminder stuff, and who did about half or more of the recordings of all the English speeches you will hear on the phone, and to Tim Britloff, who yesterday loaned us his studio to actually record, I guess, more than half of the recordings. You know how it is. Thanks.
Well done, well on time. So, next one.
Welcome to Cache Games. My lightning talk on my recent research on cache timing side channel attacks. And hello. Well, if you pay attention, you can win this bottle of Samyaki by solving my crypto challenge. The CPU cache. I assume you roughly have an idea what the CPU cache does. Essentially, it makes your memory accesses fast. If you have a cache miss, it takes long. If you have a cache hit, it's very fast because the cache supplies the data directly to the CPU core in just a few cycles. This effect can easily be measured on generic x86 CPUs with the RDTC instruction. Now, the central idea for this talk is that in a multitasking operating system, different programs run at the same time. That means after another. In this example, we have a blue program and a red program, both accessing the same memory location. And the red program observes the cache hit because the blue program accessed the same location and the data is already in the cache. That means that we have an information channel that transmits the information about the most recently accessed memory locations across the cache, and yeah, the so-called cache side channels. And with these, what's so interesting about the most recently accessed memory locations of other processes, I skip forward to, what IIS does. IIS does memory lookups in every round, the X1 and X2 into some lookup table T, and these indices leak through this cache channel. And by rewriting the first equation, you can see that I can derive key material with this attack. And I've implemented it. Some details, I'm not going to go into this because I don't have the time. This is the most important slide. This is raw output from my program. On the left side, you can directly see the cache hits and cache misses. On the right side, what my neural network does with it, it nicely filters out every single memory access. You can see I can isolate them easily. And here comes the crypto challenge. What I've written is a program that is able to extract the key from the diagram on the right side. What you need to do now is, what was the plain text in this encryption? The key used is here be dragons. If you need additional information, the slides and the raw data, I'll upload them to the wiki. If you want to see a demo of this attack, for example, I've implemented a specific case this morning, sniffing OpenVPN traffic through this CPU cache. You can contact me via these means or just talk to me. Thank you. That was Cache Games.
Okay, may I give you the keywords again? So the keywords are LaTeX, Beamer, presentation, Wiki syntax, easy code, and highlighting. And Wiki to Beamer is a small tool to create LaTeX Beamer presentations from text files with a wiki-like syntax, and thus it enables to create Beamer presentation in a less time-consuming way. Wiki to Beamer is written in Python, and you will hear more about it very soon.
Well, hello, my name is Kai, and Evince is pretty bad at rendering PDFs, so you have to live with the lines. They are not there in some other renderers. So I'll talk about how you can talk about code more easily. And as you may know, LaTeX can be used to create presentations, PDF files that are presentations. But how many presentations made with LaTeX Beamer have you seen recently? Probably very few. Well, this is sad in my opinion, because LaTeX works very well with revision control systems like Subversion, so you can very good together, you can collaborate with your with partners. WYSIWYG editors like PowerPoint aren't very good at this. There's also something else that WYSIWYG editors aren't very good at, and that's code highlighting, syntax highlighting. You have to do it manually, and if you want to have pop-ups, then you have to do this all manually and highlight this and do insert a lot of effects. So LaTeX instead can highlight source code automatically, and you don't have to do this by hand. And so I think LaTeX should be used more often for presentations, especially for presentations about source code. But there are very valid reasons not to use LaTeX. Reason number one, I think, is that it's very verbose. And there's also another reason, it's that it's very, very verbose. So let's see this. This is example slide. This simple bullet slide needs this code monster to be created. So you have this begin frame, frame title, begin itemize. This is much too verbose for my taste. So wouldn't it be nice to have just like something like this? I mean, it's just some simple wiki syntax. Yeah, that's exactly what wiki2beamer is. You just give it some LaTeX, some wiki code, and it creates your tech files. Well, it's a Python script. It's pretty simple. You put a text file in, and it puts tech code out, and then you can render it with LaTeX. So what happens if wiki2beamer syntax is not enough for you? You can fall back to LaTeX code everywhere, so you don't lose any of the power of LaTeX. So what do you want to do if you talk about code? Most of the time, if you talk about code, you just need some listings, and you want something to pop up. If you want to do this in plain LaTeX, you need huge amounts of code, but there's an alternative. Wiki2beamer has this code block, this code environment, and you just highlight or put the sections that you want to pop up into braces and specify on which page they should pop up. And you really don't want to do this in LaTeX, because this simple example extended to 40 lines of LaTeX code that's not nice to read. So wiki2beamer is by far not finished. It is a dirty preprocessor right now. I think it should be a compiler with a formal grammar and language. So if anyone here is good at this, I would really appreciate some help. It also needs some packaging for distros to be easily available. It would also be nice to have some installer for Windows, so that all our student partners can just install it and work together with us and create presentations. And of course, it needs documentation. So thank you.
So the next lightning talk is an announcement for the workshop Radio Broadcasting, and Mr. C from F, are you ready?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So radio broadcasting. Yeah. So probably for many of you, it seems like a grandfather technology dying, superseded soon by the internet. Anyway, I'm not very sure about this, because it's still very cool technology, because you have direct access, direct communication, no intermediate operators, just a radio wave directly going to the people. It's free to air, you have no subscription, no operators, no net neutrality problems. It's cheap and simple to receive, the cheap receivers. It's anonymous listening, also very important in countries where freedom of information doesn't not apply. And it's very efficient if you want to reach masses. Anyway, it's not as easy because, as you know, the spectrum is subject to license or you are a pirate. So I think it's a great technology and we shouldn't forget it. So up to now, we had two very simple ways to transmit it, AM and FM, used all around the world. And I heard one day that there are still more radio receivers in the world than mobile phones. So it's still very popular. But digital radio is coming as well, so digital technology. And we have in Europe now a deployment of DAB, DAB plus, TDMB, that permits digital broadcasting with slideshows, with AC plus, video, and so on. And you have also two other technologies, DRM, not digital right management, but digital radio mondial, which is a replacement for AM bands if we want to achieve a wide, very wide coverage, or DRM plus, which is just for simple stations. And of course, DVB-T or DVB-H can also be used. But these technologies, in fact, are not so democratic at the moment, because if you look at the infrastructure you need, this is like that. You need encoders that cost a lot of money. You need a multiplexer, transmission, OFDM modulators, and so on. And it turns out to be about 100,000 euro to start to broadcast with one transmitter of set of programs. Well, not very democratic. But there is this fantastic box that came to the market. It's really, really great. I really love it. And it costs almost nothing. I mean, $700 for what it does. It's really great. It's a cost of 200 beers, so you can spare on beers and buy this great box. And you really have the democratization of software radio. You can produce any sort of signal. The only limitation, as you know, is the CPU and the bus speed. So there are great people in Canada who did tools called MMB tools, who started to write an open multiplexer, OFDM modulator, it's free but not open, but they will open it soon, and online encoders to create, using a simple laptop and a USRP we have just seen before, a full DAB transmission. And it enables the democratization of digital radio. Many people fear that pirate radio will start again, but we'll see. Experimentation, development, and community radio may be interested. So I welcome you to come on day 3. There will be a workshop in room A03 to learn about digital radio, learn about software radio. I will bring two USRPs, so you will have the opportunity to see software radio platforms. If you have a USRP, so Universal Software Radio Platform, please bring it, and we will try to produce our own software FM transmitters, DAB transmitters, and so on. And it's really great. You can create many FM programs at the same time for the FM and the FM band, so fill in completely the FM band at a time. Really great things to do. So if you don't want to come to the workshop, there is now this website just started, opendigitalradio.org, which is about techniques, tips, and tricks for radio broadcasting. So it's a bit of syndication of free open developments and trials and so on. At the moment, we focus on DAB technologies and FM, and I have a friend who is not come, but he's specialist in RF, so he's working on amplifier and all these things to put the jam on air and so on. And there is a mailing list also. You're welcome to join if you want to just follow or you want to actively participate. Thank you.
To be fair to Matthias, there were some animations in his PowerPoint slides, but we decided to use the PDF, so you missed some animation he created. I'm sorry to you, but okay. Next talk is about Sybil Attack and DDoS with the BitTorrent DHT, and we're already starting.
Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, I read that the Pirate Bay is going to shut down their trackers, and in the future, we're going to rely on two extensions called PXChange and the distributed hash table. PXChange always works in the context of one BitTorrent file, and you will need at least one peer already to get more peers for BitTorrent. So that makes the distributed hash table crucial to get any peers. It operates on a certain key space, and there is no relation between your own node ID and the file you're downloading. Problem one is your node ID isn't verifiably random, so you could pick any and become responsible for tracker data of an arbitrary BitTorrent file. And if you do this three times, you are being solely the carrier of the tracker data. The communication in the DHT is the Kademlia request remote procedure call, and the first two queries are for the topology, the last two are for tracker data, and the basic principle is that no peer knows all other peers. You just half the key space from the ones which are very far away and keep track of just eight peers. The remaining half is halved again and halved again and halved again. So you're going to know all your very close nodes, but for the very far nodes, you keep those which have been stable for a very long time. This led me to looking at the find node query, and a find node query always contains the sender and the desired spot in the key space, which are most of the time the same. And I thought, hey, if the nodes quickly accept close peers, and we have the node ID of the sender, of the requester, we can just tell them, hey, I'm your immediate neighbor, and I can tell this to every node in the DHT. So this will lead to a lot of requests, and I can reply with arbitrary hosts and ports, and this will result in a lot of packets going to an arbitrary destination. And the second one is the tracker data itself, where I can put in arbitrary TCP hosts and ports, and this will result in a TCP DOS. And the very interesting thing is there is no central control channel like in an arbitrary botnet, and you cannot turn it off quickly. It is not as powerful, but the PS cache the hosts and ports and will retry for quite some time. This is an old version. I send you the new slides later, and I've got two implementations on GitHub, and I'd like to chat about it. What's your GitHub? Astro, and the repository is called Hash Vortex. Exactly. A-S-T-R-O.
Okay. So we have like 9 more talks today. If everything goes well, we actually have some time left. So if you want to give an announcement on your booth, on your project, or just looking for people, then please come up on stage after we're done. 9 more talks, 40 minutes. Yeah, I guess we could be done just 10 minutes before the time is up, and then we have 10 more minutes to do very quick announcements or requests.
Okay, just to introduce John, he will talk. He have 2 lightning talks because he needs some video, some demonstration. We said it's okay to use his machine. He will talk about 9 disposable digital camera vulnerabilities in 4 minutes and about the homemade Pong watch, Asteroid watch. Okay, John, your turn.
Oh, quick introduction. I just flew here from the United States. they kind of set the bar low on the flight over there. They gave me this newspaper. It says mid-air bomb attempt failed. So my flight was pretty good compared to that flight. So. Okay, so first one, first talk, nine disposable digital camera vulnerabilities in 4 minutes. Quick introduction for the disposable digital cameras. Their business model is to sell you a camera. You take your pictures, then they charge you for the development, and they keep the camera, and they make lots of profit, and you have to pay lots of money. So we went about reverse engineering this. They had a proprietary connector that wasn't too hard to figure out. It was based just USB. All cameras have some sort of authentication, so they have a challenge response, and there's a secret algorithm, and you don't know it, and if you give the right response for the challenge, you're in. So here's the first model. The download command was disabled, but peek and poke, the low-level read-write commands, were not disabled. So what did we do? We reverse engineered the flash interface, and we read the whole flash byte by byte, undid the wear level like algorithm, and then got a file system we could mount, and we got our pictures. So, first vulnerability. Oh. Second one, you could write a location to memory location EE7, and that's the variable that tells whether it's locked or not. So you could just tell it it's already unlocked. So, or you could read EE1 to EE4, which is another memory location, and that tells you the correct response it's looking for. So just tell it those numbers back and it'll be happy. And then on this first camera, the last thing we had was you could reverse engineer the whole challenge response algorithm. And if you just looked at the code in there, you could tell it was just a simple serial number multiplied by 4, converted to decimal. And so now that's actually in GPhoto. So if you've got one of these old cameras, it'll just GPhoto read it. Second generation camera, algorithms no longer in firmware, it has 1,024-bit security, sounds good. But you can ask for, there's a protocol, and you can ask for the, is the camera unlocked word. Normally that's 4 bytes, but if you say 2.5 megabytes, you get a megabyte of junk, and you get the most recent picture. So they weren't really expecting that. there were only also 6 to 8 challenge response pairs seen in the wild. So the 1,024 bits for that, but they only used a couple. So once one person figured out the correct response for the challenge, then they were all unlocked. So another one, they had a proprietary image compression format, which was really weird, and we never figured that out. But we figured out how to reflash the firmware and make it look like one of these other cameras that isn't locked. So that's another vulnerability. And then, and then the camcorder, the last model. It's basically the flip video camera, if anyone's seen that. This is the same thing, except the flip is pre-hacked. So now they've got unique keys on this. And they have this great algorithm in there that prevents buffer overflows with this formula here, which doesn't do anything. So it lets you get the challenge and the response back, and you can't get the byte past the response, but all you need is the response you're looking for. So someone messed up, should have been and 100. And then the last vulnerability, they left the algorithm on their FTP site, and we figured out that the challenge is actually just 40-bit RC2, and so we brute forced it, and took 21 PC days, which was actually a weekend because we had a whole bunch of computers going. And now forgot about this line. So we basically boost forced it. And then a bonus one, to generate their challenges, they used MS Rand, which is from GW Basic, which is supposed to give you 16-bit numbers, random numbers, not 1,024-bit random numbers. So actually, that's the security of that is more like 24 bits. So it's 1,024 sounds good. It's really more like 24. So that's it. 4 minutes, 13 seconds. That's my first. No. Then I get my second presentation. This one's more constructive. I Pong an asteroids watch. And unfortunately, my luggage is on the way to the hostel, so it's, I've got the watch, but its the batteries are dead, and if you see me tomorrow, I'll have it working, but until then, there's this. So this is a project I made. My inspiration was this Pong clock, wall-sized clock. It's beautiful. So like this, Dixie Tube watches. This one's the one that Steve Wozniak wears. It's got two digits. It's nice. I met the guy that made that. He kind of inspired me, but I wanted to do it my own way, so I got an OLED display, which just looks beautiful. And this is what the package looks like. And I did a prototype, hardware prototype, to develop the software. So I've got just a big old computer board, some glue logic, and my OLED display that's the actual one that's going to go in the watch. And I use that to develop the gameplay. But I needed a better microprocessor. This is a fast talk, so I'll go quick. this one's smaller, lower power than the one that I had in my original one, and it's got an accurate clock, so that it actually keeps time without, because you want a watch to do that. And I used a better power supply. This one's super tiny. I could have used a lithium battery, like just non-rechargeable. That would have given me 8 days of life. But you'd have to change it every 8 days. So I use this 33-hour one, which is rechargeable, so you can just charge it every night, which I did not do. So the neat thing is about making a watch is that you get to design your own case, so it's just some inspiration. I like that square one. This one looked a little easier for me to make, kind of in shape. This one I love, but it's a little too complicated for me to make. I'm not quite good at machining, so I'm more software. So here's my first case, just basic square and some cutouts in the back for the stuff and a little hole for the battery charger. I prototyped it, and here's me milling it out of wood, and there's the first wood prototype. It's not too wearable, but so I made a plastic one. And so here's a 0.5-millimeter pencil, and if you see over there, there's the smallest parts in the whole thing. So I had a microscope to solder all up. It's the watch. It's going to be small. So there's the main circuit board for the first watch, and there's a dime, pretty small. There's the power supply, the processor, the crystal that keeps time, the connector that goes to the display, and then you can tell I laid the board out from left to right because I had some room on the right side when I was done to put my name in it, so I had to fill it. So here's the inside of that watch, and that's what it looks like with the battery on the right and the processor board on the left, and underneath it all is a display, which kind of drives the whole size of the thing. And there's a finished product for my Pong watch. It works just like the Pong clock. What I loved about the Pong clock is that every minute the right side makes a point, and every hour the left side makes a point. So if you look at the score, it's actually the time. So I stole that totally. I worked on a second version. This one has an accelerometer. And I'll show you the second version when it's done, but this is just a little side note. This is the world's smallest Pong game. It's there's a penny, it's a small, small coin. It's actually got a LCD display on there it's liquid crystal on silicon, and the silicon has a Pong game built into it. So this whole thing is like a quarter inch, I'm not sure what that is in metric, but small, the whole display, and it plays Pong, and that's shipped in millions of cameras, and it was a secret, don't tell anyone, it was like my company, some engineers, rogue engineers did that. So here's my, here's the final slide, the asteroids watch. And then there's the original Pong watch and the asteroids watch. So I don't have a charge right now. When I get my luggage, I'll have it tomorrow. So if you see me, I'll have a shiny red backpack. Just stop me and I'll be wearing it and you can see it. So that's it.
Okay, thanks, John. I think the videos were worth changing the laptops and to have some interruption. The next talk will be about an upcoming community meeting. Again, I give you the keywords. It's Whiteland Community Meeting and Game. And Whiteland is a real-time strategy game, so we will be hearing about this now.
Right, so, yeah, it used to be like, I've got this new nice phone and it has games, and do we have that game? And now it's all, I have this game thing and you can also talk with it. I think the next step will be like, does your watch have that game? So, that was quite nice. Let us change it over like this. Mm-hmm. Okay, two more speakers have actually shown up. So we will have like 9 more talks there, and which might fill up today's time. And yes, I promise to put online the talks that have been today with the slides that we got, and everything will be fine and better tomorrow. And still, we have about 42, 43 talks already submitted, but I think we can go up to 80 and even more. So there's still room on day 3 and day 4. So think about what kind of talk you will be giving, and please contact us at 263@lightningtalks.de. And please also give some feedback on the IRC channel on Freenode, which is 26#2063LT. Right, thanks.
So, hello everybody. My name is Holger Rapp, aka Server. You can find my email address down here. And I want to talk about the Whitelands open source game. That will be my first topic. And the second topic is our upcoming community meeting, which will happen just a few days from now in Karlsruhe. You have all the information on the slide, but the information will come out later again on another slide. So I want to talk to you about Whitelands first, because I think not everybody knows it. What is Whitelands? Whitelands is a free, slow-paced, built-up, real-time strategy game. It is free because it is licensed under the GPL. It is slow-paced because a game can last for hours or days. It's built up because you don't have to destroy things like in StarCraft or WarCraft, but you have to build things up. It is real-time because all players play at the same time, so it's not turn-based in any way, and it's strategy, so you need brains and not a trigger finger or something. And it's a lot of fun. And actually, it's also very old, so I think it's in its 9th year now. So the basic principle is just easily shown. You start up with this headquarters of yours, which is just on a map. And you can then use your mouth and order construction sites. For example, I ordered the construction sites here down on the left, and connected it to my road system. And then my people start carrying stuff there, wares that are needed to build up the construction site. And when it's done, the worker moves in and starts working. So you can see that somebody is chopping on the stones at the left. And this will give you back one more stone, and you have new resources to build new stuff. Actually, because it is quite old and quite successful, you can try it for yourself quite easily, because we are in practically all port trees that there are out there. The game runs on everything that has a CPU. And so just give it a try. It's a lot of fun. And you can find more information about the game on our homepage, which is just wlwhitelands.org. Okay, so much for the game. The more important thing is the WHAG 2010. So WHAG is actually an acronym that stands for a lot of things, depending on who you are going to ask. Actually, we needed something that's good for telling your boss and something that's good for telling your friends. So we decided for this one. And what it will be is a developer and gamers meeting. So we want to advance the game there, so a lot of developers will be there. And we have some projects planned that we want to do. But we also want to play. So it really doesn't matter if you know the game, or if you know some programming language or something, or if you just want to game with us, just come there. It's a coding and playing event. Everybody's welcome. It's free of charge. But if you want to help out, nearly all skills are useful for Whitelands. So we have artists, we have programmers, C, C++, Python, we have web designers. And if you just know something, come there, help out. I think that's pretty much it. Oh yeah, maybe very important, it happens in Karlsruhe and it starts just a few days from now on the 2nd of January 2010 and it will end on the 5th of January 2010. And if you have any more questions and want to know anything about this, just write me an email. I'm not so much of a telephone guy, so I don't have a deck. Just write me an email, I'm reading them constantly. Thanks.
The next two lightning talks are done by Kerstin, and she will talk. Her first lightning talk will be about open hardware, open design, and community. And her second lightning talk will be about open source, open hardware, and survey results.
Hello. So my name is Kerstin Balker, and in the first talk I want to tell you about open innovation projects. So what is it? Some time ago, I started looking around for open hardware projects on the internet, and I found it pretty tough to find open hardware projects because I didn't find any collection of projects yet, like you would find them in a software domain. And well, that's why I decided about 1.5 years ago to start my own collection of projects, and I named it Open Innovation Projects. So on Open Innovation Projects, you will now find open design projects. Well, I'm talking about open product design, so don't confuse it with web design. I know the terming is a little bit weird. And you also have the chance to promote your own projects. So what people are doing here, they're standing around and telling you about projects. You can also put them there and tell people about it. What kind of projects am I talking about? We are not creating yet another directory of open source software projects. We are also not listing pure IT hardware projects. We want to build a community of open design projects, and as far as I know, there is no other community out there right now which has as many projects as we have them. And of course, it's all open source, it's licensed under Creative Commons license, so we follow the spirit there. As of today, there are 128 projects registered, and they come from a number of different industries, where the largest industries are consumer electronics and IT hardware. Well, this seems natural, of course, as there are strong similarities to software development in this area. But we also have a number of different industries, like automotive, machinery, pharma, etc., where you would probably less expect to find open source projects. On our directory, we are not only listing the projects, we are also collecting information about them along 20 characteristics. And two of them, which I brought as an example here, are the community size and the development stages. So what you can see from the chart is that you can find all sort of projects on this directory, starting from very small with just a couple of developers to very large projects with more than 1,000 or more than 5,000 developers in the community. And we also have projects along all stages of development, so from very early beginning planning stages up to stable production stages, which means that they are fully functional products permanently available on the market. So that was it for the first talk. Thank you very much.
So then is the openness, right?
And in my second talk, I'm going to tell you about openness and satisfaction in software and hardware, where I'm switching the role a little bit, and I want to tell you about my research work. So as Mitch said in one of the first talks, he told us you should do the job that you love, and that's why I decided to write my doctoral thesis on the topic of open source. And I'm especially focusing on the meaning of openness. And I figured out that many people think of openness in a more binary black and white style. Things can either be open or closed. And I thought, well, maybe there's something in between, and I want to look on the different aspects of openness and treat it more as a continuous variable looking on different degrees of openness. And then in the next step, I thought, well, so now that I have all those enthusiasts of open source like you are in this room, but does openness really affect the satisfaction in the community? So if you're having a community of an open product and the company behind is giving out information, would that make the people in the community more satisfied? And the second question I asked, as I said, I'm looking at open hardware, was are there any differences between software and hardware in this regard? So what about the relation between openness and satisfaction when you're looking at software and hardware? And I've also been looking at different aspects of openness and ask myself, well, okay, does it make any differences in that part? So what I've been doing, I conducted a survey in 20 open source communities, very big communities like OpenMoko, RepRub, One Laptop Per Child, etc. I received 309 responses in the months September and October. So it's not too big, but it's enough for doing some reliable statistics. And now I want to show you the statistics. So what I learned from the results is that openness is important for the community, and it indeed shows a significant impact on developer satisfaction. But what I also found is that if I distinguish between software and hardware, then only openness of software is affecting the satisfaction, and the openness of the hardware does not have any impact on the satisfaction of the developers in the community. So, why is that the case? Why do people ask for open hardware if it does not make them more satisfied if they'll get it? So I have one more thing I want to show you. I've been looking at different aspects of openness, and I distinguish between three parts here. So one is transparency. By transparency, I mean the availability and quality of information. Then I've been looking at accessibility, so the possibility to influence the development. And replicability, so the possibility for self-assembly of the product. And by doing the same analysis as before, I found out that only transparency and accessibility impact the satisfaction of the people in the community, but replicability does not have any impact. So it appears not to be important to the developers whether or not they can produce the product themselves if they want to. Well, I thought interesting results, and I hope that some of you have an opinion on this and come to me and talk about it, because I would really love to know why the results are telling me that hardware is not important at all, and that also the replicability, so the self-assembly of the product, is not important to the people. Thank you very much.
So, next on the list, Münich, the crypto stick.
Yeah, we will hear about a small USB stick, and yes. I think he was there.
I kind of remember that he wasn't, so...
Okay, maybe we fucked up this again. Yeah. So, let's continue.
Emrys.
Sai, are you ready?
Good. Hi, everyone. So, what I'm going to talk about is a proposal. It's just a proposal, though. There's no code behind this. It's just an idea that I had for how to do a new steganographic file system. So, the problem is I really like current file systems that try to hide your data and try to encrypt your data and all that. I've got TrueCrypt on my laptop. It's cool. The problem is they're all kind of suspicious. They leave traces behind, or they want you to reserve a big chunk of your hard drive that if any auditor is looking at it will be glaringly obvious as maybe they can't prove that it's TrueCrypt because they don't have your key, but a 1 gigabyte file that has random data on your hard drive probably is TrueCrypt. The usual answer to this is that you use what's called rubber hose systems, where you have plausible deniability. You can open up your fake file system, it looks real, it has files in it, and then you really use your other one that you use with a different password. Problem is, you probably don't maintain it very well. And the cops know that maybe you have a second file system there, and they can just keep you in jail until you give up both of your passwords. And you can claim you only have one password, or you forgot the other one, or whatever, but it's not a good situation. So what I propose is a free space file system. Basically, the idea is all disks have free space, right? You have any perfectly normally formatted disk, it has free space that you're just not using. What we can do is write to that free space. We don't tell the host file system, of course, that we're doing this. We just secretly store data where it thinks nothing is being allocated. The benefits are that if no one notices that you have anything, then you don't need to deny anything. Another benefit is that just in the course of using the system, it'll get destroyed if you don't keep it up. So if you turn off your system and the user just downloads a big file, whatever, the free space will get moved around, will get allocated by the main system, by the host, and therefore it goes away. And you don't really have to use up the user's space because it's free, et cetera. And you don't need a complicated Linux volume manager or whatever. Those are cool, don't get me wrong, but you know, they're just kind of messy. If you want to be a black hat about it, you could install it on someone's computer without their knowledge. You could store your data there. You're not going to be using up their hard drive space. So normally, if you have a bot on somebody's computer and you're storing, you know, 10 gigabytes of wares, then they're going to notice because you're taking up space on their hard drive, and suddenly they don't have very much space left free. But if you do this, it won't. And suppose your internet connection to them gets cut off, they do a virus scan, whatever, you're not leaving cruft behind that'll get you caught and in jail. There are some drawbacks, of course. Because you have to sort of maintain it, you have some higher disk use when you shuffle chunks around so that they stay propagated. And unless you do something special, which I'll get to in a second, it's volatile because the disk is constantly assigning free space to a new file or moving stuff around or defragging or whatever. So this is actually a feature, not a bug, as far as I'm concerned. So, yes. There are ways you can address this. You can store stuff redundantly. You can just not rely on it as like a permanent store. You can treat it more as a caching system. And you can try to hook into the host a little bit more deeply to try to say, if you're going to allocate some space, try to avoid my, quote unquote, my chunks first. But then if you have to allocate them, go ahead. It has a few vulnerabilities. I think they're sort of inherent to having anything that's cryptographically stored on a file system, on a drive, rather. But you know, you can't really get around it. So in summary, you have something that's not suspicious. Unless it's running, it's not detectable, and unless you keep it running, it'll wipe itself. It's compatible with a perfectly normal setup. You can have just 100% of the disk used by an NTFS file system. Nothing suspicious, everything is accounted for, and if the host wants to use 100% of the drive, you can just let it use it. So if you're interested, let's talk. And that deck doesn't work until tomorrow because I haven't gotten a phone yet. And one plug, I have two other things. So tomorrow in that room, you can learn how to make a language, and we'll make one on the spot together. And on day 4, there is a meditation workshop and get your inoculation against Scientology. Thank you very much.
So this is one. Okay, thanks, Sai. Next, we have a guest from Sweden. He's talking about, can I say fuck? Is this okay for you?
Because yes, you can say fuck.
Okay.
All right.
Because in his title, he didn't write it. So what the fuck is up with Sweden is the title. Again, I give you the keywords. It's hackerspaces, history, and Sweden. So Taksamoka, and go on.
Thank you. Hello, friends. I am Kuji. I'm from Sweden. I have a hacker space in my local city called Forskningsavdelningen, or the Forsk. The Forsk. Yes, say the Forsk. It's like a fork, but with an S. Okay. So our space recently got raided. Maybe you still saw the news. I'm going to tell you, or try to answer you, the question that you're now asking yourself: why did this happen? That didn't work. So what's up? The space we make a public statement in the papers 1 week before the raid, and we are talking about hacking in general and how good and open we are, etc. we get raided 1 week later. We don't have any charges against us. We don't have any real accusations. We have lots and lots of slander from the police and attorney's office, where they're accusing us of different things. I'll come back to that. Next slide. So the police seized a lot of stuff from us, and this includes computers, key cutting machines, etc. A lot of stuff, and we're asking to have them back. So what they're saying is, when they came to the hackerspace, they realized as they came there that there must be some kind of intrusion going on, right? And I mean, yeah, there was an intrusion. Cops were there and all, and also they're saying, or implying, that we will only return your computers if you give up the crypto key. I'm not going to go into details about that for your specific computers. Okay, so the slander. Sweden has a history of, during all computer-related seizures, there's always slander involved. You remember the Pirate Bay, when they accused the Pirate Bay guys for hosting child porn sites? There was one guy here from my city, his name's Dan, and he hosted a Tor node, and he exposed that traffic is going through the Tor node, and when he sniffed it and published it, he got a raid, and after this raid, he got accused for fencing. And fencing means to sell and buy things that are stolen, because he had 7 video games. And they didn't mention, though, in the papers afterward, that the guy owned a video game store. And by Swedish history, this is 1984, there was a hacker group in Sweden called the SHA, the Swedish Hackers Association, where this guy, Stefan Kronqvist, he's just a newly graduated cop, and he says, the youngsters, like so-called hackers, have created their own ethics and rules where you must break every possible rule. And he's like going on and on about hackers being really mean and stuff. And this guy is now the head of IT police, and I'll come back to him as well. In this slide, this is the ambassadors that I've encountered from the people in power, so to say, so far. Stefan Kronqvist is the head of IT police, and he makes statements like this constantly. He also was the one who said that the Pirate Bay is about the child porn, mostly. And Jim Kaser is another one that he appointed because he's a specialist in copyright laws and copyright, and he is also employed by Sony BMG at the same time while being a cop. And then we have the Anti-Piracy Agency, which is not a governmental agency, just a detail, and they are running their own sort of corporate trials against people and charging into people's homes and stealing CDs, etc. And this makes people really upset. So the mood set here is that hackers are really upset and the authorities are really upset in their corner, right? So the reason why this splits so much is because I think this is the same all over the world. It's not about Sweden. Police have one thing in common and one thing difference between hackers. The thing in common is no one of them are motivated by money. Police actually believes, I think, that they're doing this, what they're doing, and they're doing it because it's the law and because it's right. And hackers, they believe that you have to try every single option before you know what's right. In many cases, I'm not implying that everyone is trying everything, but that's the way of working for the hacker. And this creates desperation from the police sites, because you get more and more hackers or actually reported crimes committed, such as copyright infringement. And this creates increased resources for surveillance, which creates desperations amongst the hackers, which tend to go underground. And it's an increased conflict between the two parties. So the outcome of this is, in Sweden, we have a quite big party called the Pirate Party, which only purpose is to protect innovative people, basically, and to protect all the people from these kind of laws and from this this downgoing spiral I just explained. We have ISPs who actually don't cooperate with police, and in most cases they refuse to give out information to police. And why is that? This is not the case in the 90s. If you go back in time, this is not the case, right? And we, the hackers are going underground. All right, so what do I want? I do not want to be a marcher. I don't want to be an icon or anything. I want to explore and hack, right? So how do I get through with this? First of all, when I start, or when you guys start a new project, think of, what's your expectation from the reaction from others? What's your wish? What do you wish that people would? How do you wish that they would react? If they don't match, you're probably surprised, and you should document this on some public place. If you're disappointed, then you should start acting and making something, like going to CCC and have a talk about it, right? And I don't know how much time I have left, but I'll just finish this off. By saying, so you all know the statement of our crime is out of curiosity, and curiosity is a big threat to those who refuses to change. And that's the reason why a lot of new projects coming up, especially in a cold country like Sweden, get their eyes or their attention on by the Big Brother. And I think it's important to be aware that this is the reason and this is the schism that we have. And I want you to contact me on my deck number or email or in face-to-face after this talk to talk about the situation. I can explain a lot about what's happening, etc. Thank you.
So, thanks so much, Christoph, for telling us the situation in Sweden. The next talk will be about the Free Fermentology Foundation. And the keywords are fermentation, do-it-yourself, biotech, and kombucha.
Hello, everyone. I'm Vincent Gross. I'm coming from Paris. I'm here to introduce you the Free Fermentology Foundation. So let's start right away. So how many people here do know about the Milbenkäse? Yeah, one. 2, 3, 4, 5, well, not that many. Well, still quite a lot. Well, Milbenkäse, so yeah, cheese fermented with the digestive juice of cheese mites. For those of you who know, most of the time cheese is done with yeast or products coming directly from the digestive system of the animals or other living organisms. But actually, yes. What?
Don't tell us.
Come on, it's natural. So anyway, this cheese particularly is done with a little insects living on the crust of the cheese. And it was only prepared in a small town, Würschwitz, south of Sachsen-Anhalt. And it's a tradition that went back to the Middle Ages and was no less in 1970 when only one old woman knew how to make this kind of cheese. And then we had two professors that grabbed some interest on the subject and perpetuated the tradition. And now the Milbenkäse production is flourishing. But we have the same kind of problem all around the world of fermentation tradition and the verge of disappearing, or unknown. Well, there are many fermentation traditions that you know, sauerkraut, kimchi, kombucha, kefir, natto. I think most of you know about kombucha. Kimchi is a traditional biotech from Korea. Natto from Japan, kefir from the Middle East, and all those are processes that are very subtle. You cannot just recreate them from the ground. You have to have the existing bacteria and yeast and symbiosis. And once it has disappeared, very little hope to bring it back. And they are on the verge of extinction because, overbearing hygienic norm inside the European Union and the USA, almost every Western country, big agro businesses like Danone or Kraft Foods, well, it's not something that's easily reproducible, so they got no interest with that. And for the layman, for your grandma, well, not maybe your grandma, because, well, let's say your former history teacher. The biotech is, it's a scary thing. Well, I don't know, well, how many pipes or devices, but, well, this is way too complicated. When in fact it's really simple. You just lay it and wait. So, what's the Free Fermentology Foundation? Free Fermentology Foundation is a project that aims to make an inventory of all the existing fermentation tradition all around the world, and also to collect the bacteria, the yeast, the germs, to safeguard them, to hold, it's very akin to this project that stored several seeds in the groundland. It's a bit like this. And of course, exchanging the raw materials with a bit of everyone, organizing biotech experiments, and of course, spreading the knowledge not only amongst hackers, but amongst everyone. Schoolboys, employees, whatever. Even political men. So, just how will it work? Mostly by everyone's doing experiments at home. All right.
Finish up.
Yeah. Okay. Everyone will do experiments at home and exchanging ferment. So we still need some infrastructure. That was the last slide. So, what can you do to get more information? So we have a website by now, which is, yeah, it's a beginning. We just created a mailing list to coordinate efforts from people from everywhere. We still need some kind of infrastructure to coordinate the different experiments. So if you've got some web dev skills, help, welcome. And to have a taste, we have some free kimchi at the fact table, and I got a feeling that as soon as we'll open the bags, we will have lots of space around us. Thanks.
Right. So.
Okay, merci. The next talk is one I am looking forward to. It's about sleep hacking. And the keywords are polyphasic sleep, sleep stages, dreaming, and napping. And I think we'll all learn a lot now.
So once I learned that vitamins are the little creatures running around on salad, now I learned that there's cheese with little thingies on them. And sometimes I regret knowing all these things. Yeah, there's worse cheese, I know, but I don't want to know.
Okay, so I think I don't need to tell you what hacking is all about. Let me start off. I'm Christiane, or many of you know me as Paula, and well, hacking is about learning something about a topic and then using it for fun and profit or doing things with it that you wouldn't anticipate for beforehand. And so this is about sleep, and it's very natural. You all do it quite frequently, but little know what's going on. And basically, what's governing our daily cycle is that circadian cycle. That means you get tired in the night and you're awake at day. And what happens over the day is there are some hormones flowing through your system and they build up and make you tired. And the most important about those are the melatonin and the neurotransmitter adenosine and the cortisol. But actually, when you start looking around, there's very little known about what's actually going on. And so here's just a quick tour of what's happening, at least in the night. So in the night, you go through at least four stages. And This is a particularly curious example where in the later part of the night there was no deep sleep, but this is not representative. So what you're seeing is when you're starting to sleep in, you will go through the phases, the first, the second, and the third. And the third one, it's very deep sleep. You shouldn't want to try to awake when you're in very deep sleep. And after that, so that's around 1 hour and 15 minutes or 1 hour into your sleep cycle, you start dreaming. That are the red plateaus in the diagram. And in the later phases, at about 3 hours in the morning, you will see that you actually awake. And this happens quite frequently at night. And those are the times that you should try to, well, put your alarm clock to, so you get not awoken when you're in a deep state, but when you're rather awake. And so the easiest sleep hack is sleep more, a multiple of 1.5 hours. It's about 1.5 hours in young people. It gets up to 2 hours per sleep cycle in older people. And you will see that you get out of bed quite easy when you start doing that. Another thing you can do is sleep cycle recognition with motion sensors on your wrists that will wake you up when you start moving in your sleep. So that will be quite a convenient way to get off bed in the morning. So, but you can go deeper. You can start hacking your sleep cycle by not sleeping, a so-called core sleep at night, but you will start sleeping with a nap in the afternoon. That's what many of you know from your grandparents and so on. That's called a biphasic sleep. So what you actually will notice is that they will get really refreshed and awake after just a half hour of sleep in the noon. And, well, there must be something to it. And so people who are left to themselves, who are not coupled to the daylight cycle, some of them find themselves sleeping for being awake for 4 hours and then sleeping for half an hour, then being awake for 4 hours and sleeping again, and that over the whole day, which that's actually the Huberman cycle I'm picturing here. That's just a nap and being awake. Okay. You can have several other modes, like the Everman sleep. That's a core cycle, like two or three core cycles in the night. And that means you'd only have to do two or three naps a day, and this will actually amount to quite some time you have over the day. So you have time for more hobbies. You should really want to try to stay awake if you're pondering messing with your sleep. You will get into the cycle by sleep deprivation, which means you will stay up for a night and then you will start napping, and you will soon learn that when you apply some relaxation techniques or meditation, that you will really get some, well, increasingly refreshing sleep out of it. So you can stay up the whole night by doing 4 hour spaced naps, and you can stay awake for days, and that's quite interesting if you have got another two hobbies to do. So there's actually a very good collection on Wikipedia going on polyphasic sleep. They've got many links to blogs and information going on out there, where people who blog about doing polyphasic sleeping. One to mention is polynap.grally.com. She is collecting sleep tracks that you will put on your MP3 player, and that will cover up any environmental noise by white noise or pink noise or brown noise mixtures, so you can sleep in the office. And that's pretty convenient to do if you're flexible enough. Okay. But since time is up, there's a workshop coming on at 1500. So if you're interested, join me in B04, and we can go through it. You will see where it goes from there, and you will determine where it goes. So I would be happy to talk more about it. So thanks for listening.
We will now come to the last talk of the day. We could probably go into the break, but we don't, so you have time to actually have a break. So there's one more. Oh, wait. And I completely missed out on you. There might be two talks.
Sorry, guys, for taking another 4 minutes of your time. Everybody's tired by now, but I'll try to be very short. The talk is not prepared. So look at me, not on the slide.
Wait, there are no slides, but there's a name and an address, right, which you should see. Right. So.
So that's it for today. Oh, okay, my talk. I have to say that any, and I repeat, any association with my employer is misplaced and is wrong. So that's what I'm doing in my private time. I deeply hate patents. And I think there are many people here who hate patents too, because patents make much of the harm to our society, to our technology. So companies spend too much time and resources to circumvent the patents, to search what patents are existing, to patent their product itself. So the idea is, and I would like to find the community for that, there are two problems I will talk about. The idea is to make an open platform for all ideas. So if you have the open platform for all ideas and everybody can submit the idea, then in a couple of years, the whole patent system will be obsolete. Why? Because if you publish the idea, openly publish the idea, then it cannot be patented anymore. So there are two problems in that. There should be a reliable community which is willing to support that. And the second problem is technical. You have to assign the timestamp to the idea. If there is no timestamp, that will be, well, questionable in any trial, in any court trial. Because if Microsoft goes to the court and says, well, this is the idea which was published on the internet, but there's no reliable timestamp, and they have hacked that, and they have put this idea yesterday on the internet, and not 1 year ago as they claim. So reliable, and maybe it's the wrong word here in the hackerspace, that the timestamp should not be hackable. So that should be absolutely reliable. This is the technical problem. If someone can help with that, with the timestamp problem, okay, thanks, I'll talk to you later. And if there is the community, if there are, well, people who want to support such platform, who deeply hate patents as I do in my private time, then we can talk about that. Thanks very much.
All right, I promised you a break. I'm breaking that. So here's one more talk for today.
Right, this is going to be a very highly compressed talk. The last time I gave this talk, it was 90 minutes. I was giving it to an audience who were not sure about what is XML. Okay, thank you. So I'm going to give you the big picture first of all. The big picture is social software, but not in one place with all the data. You have your data on your server with your public-private key pair, so you can contact me directly. So we could make a decentralized network of XML machines. That's what I'm making here. And I want to say, okay, this is not distributed programming. This is not a whole load of machines which are all operating one program, because your machine is doing your things with your software on it, with your data, with your friends. So what is F2F, the architecture? It's P2P plus keys, so you know who is contacting you. Identity is based on strong cryptography. So is the web distributed programming? Well, each website is doing its own thing, but what's giving you? You are just getting a page. That's a piece of text. That's not good for semantic web. That's not intended to program. That's not a two-way thing. It's a bit of a stretch. It's like a dumb terminal. So clients are sending data. We've done this. You know, you go to Google, you're making a post request, you're making a get request, but it's a pretty dumb request. And Google is doing some clever things, but you don't see that. You just get a piece of text back again. So look at that in terms of programming. Then, okay, I don't have a mouse, but you can see we've got code, which we know, we write programs, and arguments which is untrusted. So that's the functions which are passed to the program, and it's by design. You don't want people writing code and running it on your machine, do you? Well, if you know who they are, you might want that. So this is normal programming, separates out arguments from code. So I'm going to say, if I'm going to send something to somebody, I might want to say, okay, here's the data. I might want to say, I can't access the data, but this is how you get the data, because you've got permissions. So data is no longer separate from code. It doesn't have to be. And they have a common format that's called XML. So what is running on these machines is basically an XML machine. It takes input XML, outputs XML, so you can network them together. So site can dynamically script another site, and we're going beyond, oh, I'm going here, I'm getting a piece of HTML, I'm bringing it back. You can chain what is the request between the sites. So how to program it? There's one XML item with a URI that identifies it uniquely. So the virtual machine says, okay, I can process that. Here's some XML as a result. Whether it crashes, whatever, it's only giving XML because the output of one is the input of another. Okay, I wasn't sure who knows XSLT, but XSLT is a W3C standard language from a long time ago for transforming an XML document into another XML document, and side effect free. I'm going to show you the Hello World service. So we have Hello World identifier. The server says, okay, yeah, das kann ich machen. So it locates that as an XSLT transform. That's an XML transform. So it goes through the script. That's the output. So that's how you make a function call in an ordinary language. And you're passing in parameters as static data. So you know that how that works. A more transparent alternative is to use XML. So why is that helpful? Well, the XML input document is the request. If you can see how that's going to work, that's how to program in this language. When you're nesting calls, we've written programming languages like this, the deeper ones get transformed first. So you're passing XML by default. You can change it, but by default, the deeper service requests are processed first. So that gets replaced with the output of the service. So when the outside one has only got static content, that becomes the deepest service req that gets processed. So, okay, yeah, there's about three more. What I'm saying is XML pipeline, then the output of the one transform becomes the input of the next transform. So by specifying any XML document, you can do any XML pipelining. So the only last piece to add, because XSLT is transforming one XML document into another XML document, it's side effect free. But hey, we want to write some data. I want to read some data. I want to open a HTTP connection and secure it. So we have some services which are hard coded. So it's not using XSLT. So that adds the bits which XSLT was missing. And that's the summary. Your F2F server is an XML virtual machine that forms a decentralized network with your data and networks only with your friends. You can do any XML pipelining, and the base language is XML, and you can write software for it, and that's it.
I will have to look at the recording and think about this again. That was pretty quick. Okay. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for the speakers. I hope you'll be back tomorrow and send us your feedback. Thank you very much. Bye.